So this week is going to be a little bit of an adventure, and you're going to see what monastery life is in real time. And you're just going to be part of our community for the week. So the program isn't designed, we'll put it this way, it is designed so that you get a real experience of community life and of practicing the Dharma in a community, okay? So it's not designed as a program just to have teachings and meditation and so on, but really showing how things kind of happen in life and how you apply your spiritual practice to your life. So as part of our community this week, you know, different things happen. We happen to have some people who are coming over from Montana who are doing a little bit of filming. They're helping us to make a short video about the Abbey, telling people what it is. Not a video, but a slideshow. So they're going to be taking pictures and filming, and Venerable Chui is going to be involved with that. And then also we're in the midst of negotiating a contract to build Chenrezig Hall, which is our next building, which will be on this very spot. We're thinking of moving this entire building up the hill. This is all just planning stages, putting out ideas, moving this building up the hill, and then Chenrezig Hall will start here and go somewhere around here. Our architect will figure that out. And it's going to have a kitchen and dining room and guest rooms, things like that. So we're going to be doing a signing of the contract sometime this week. And so you'll be there to do that. When we sign a contract, we don't just sit down and sign the contract and send it in. We do a whole meditation about it because from our viewpoint, you know, whatever you're doing in life so much depends on your motivation, why you're doing something, not just what you're doing. And so we want to take the time and really contemplate our motivation for building the hall and generate aspirations about how the hall will be used and the benefit that people will receive from being there. And so to us, setting this kind of intention and aspiration is a very important part of doing something. Yeah, we don't just do it. We really think clearly about what we do before we do it. So you'll be here for that. Some of our neighbors that actually live 10 minutes away, but they're neighbors, you know, when you live out in the wilderness here, they're going to come over this afternoon. I'm going to talk to them a little bit about Chenrezig Hall, so you'll see some other people here. And then another thing that's happening this week is one of our nuns finally got her R1 visa. You may hear a lot about immigration in the news, you know, and all these people want to build fences along the border and, you know, deport illegal immigrants. Personally speaking, since most of the people in this country are the descendants of immigrants, very few are Native Americans. To me, the idea of not letting immigrants come in and kicking them out is absolutely ridiculous. But our country is being very, very difficult regarding immigration, even to Canadians who are, you know, so much like us. So this nun is Canadian, and we applied for an R1 visa for her. R1 is a non-immigrant religious worker visa so that she can come and be a nun here. And it's taken 9 months for the immigration department to okay it. She's been stranded in Canada all this time, and she's hopefully arriving back this evening. All her papers are in order, and if they hassle her in the border, So she'll be coming back this evening, and so some of the nuns are going to go down to the airport and pick her up and welcome her, and you'll see her tomorrow morning, and we'll all be very excited to have her back in the community again after all this time. So, you know, you'll just see regular community life and how you bring what you learn in the Buddha's teachings to your life, you know, and how you practice together living with other people. Because one of, you know, it's one thing to sit on your meditation cushion. I mean, that's already another thing. Being friends with ourselves is one thing, isn't it? You know, you sit on the cushion and try and focus on your breath, and your mind's like all over the universe. So, you know, trying to calm our mind is one thing. But then trying to live together with other people is another thing, you know. And sometimes we can, in our meditation, you know, have really good experiences in our meditation and feeling real good and resolve a lot of issues. And then the proof of, you know, kind of how far we're getting is how we relate to other people outside of our meditation session, you know. So when somebody doesn't like the way you do the dishes and tells you to do them differently, then to watch how your mind reacts. You might find a few people telling you to do the dishes differently than the person who told you last how to do them differently. We often have skits at the end of the young adult week, and so was it young adult or was it EML?
It was young adult.
It was young adult, and one time they did a skit about doing the dishes and how each Abbey resident came up and corrected them slightly from the way the other previous one did it. So we had a good laugh. And a little embarrassment. But, you know, then you watch your mind, you know. How does your mind react when people tell you how to do things? Yeah, and we get a really good perspective on how we relate. Well, first of all, who we put in positions of authority, how we relate to authority, how we conceive of somebody is telling me what to do, therefore they are controlling me and inhibiting my freedom and my creativity, and therefore I'm going to get angry and rebel. And you can watch that chain of thought and then, you know, just sit and go, is that completely reasonable? You know? Is everybody who gives me advice trying to control me and limit my freedom? Maybe they're trying to help, you know. And so we get an opportunity to really look at these things. And this is part of our growth. This is part of our Dharma practice, you know. And I'm saying this because very often people have the idea that, you know, with spiritual practice, you're going to sit there and transcend and go into, you know, some other universe, and everything, you're going to have bliss and light, and everybody's going to love you, and you're going to see the Buddha, and the Buddha's going to say, oh, I've been waiting for you to come all these years. You're the best person in the whole universe. Come. And, you know, we have all sorts of fanciful ideas of spiritual experience, yeah. And that's just what they are, fanciful ideas. Okay. I remember one time many years ago I was in Hong Kong, and I was living in Hong Kong, and I was asked to speak at an international school. And so there was one little girl who raised her hand and she said, can you talk to God? And I said, no. I didn't tell her I didn't believe in God, but I just said no. And one little boy raised his hand and he said, can you bend a spoon without touching it? And I said no. And I said, you know, for me, being able to bend a spoon without touching it or talking to God, these aren't really what's important to me, you know. What I consider important is if I can have a kind heart towards other people, you know? And to me, having a kind heart is spiritual practice. You know, it sounds so easy to have a kind heart, doesn't it? You know, at Christmas time, everybody's writing, you know, peace on earth and goodwill towards men. They forget that half the population is women. But you know, they we all think having a kind heart is great. But how many people do you know who have a kind heart all the time, consistently? You know, and I was told as a kid, do unto others the way you want them to do unto you. But I didn't see people doing that. I saw them, people being, you know, really kind to themselves, i.e. self-indulgent, you know, mistaking self-indulgence for kindness to themselves, and then not so kind to other people. And I thought, something's wrong here. You know? So actually, being a kind person is quite an achievement, you know, because it means doing something with our anger. Yeah. When you're angry, is calming yourself easy? Yeah. Can you just say, I don't want to be angry, and then stop being angry? No. When you're angry, what do? You know? Do you go sulk? Do you scream? How many are sulkers? Slam the door and I'm going to go sulk. How many are screamers and tell other people it's all your fault? How many people do both? Yeah. Well, you see, it's not so easy to do something with our anger. And sometimes when we try, if we don't know really how to do, you know, work with our anger, then what we do is we stuff it in our heart and say, oh, I'm not angry. You know, and the anger's sitting there. And then, you know, pretty soon, we explode. Yeah? So really knowing how to work with our anger and become tolerant and patient and able to bear difficulty. Not so easy. Yeah? So I think real spiritual practice is about this kind of transformation that actively influences the way we live our life. Yeah? You know, we hear about, you know, the emptiness of inherent existence is the ultimate truth. And we think, oh, I'm going to realize emptiness and then go to some other planet, you know, and abide happily ever after in the planet called emptiness. You know, and then we think, oh, empty, that's great, then there's nobody to bug me. Oh, I like that. You know, well, that's not emptiness. That's the absence of people who bug you is not the ultimate reality. Okay. So, you know, I mean, why do we want to realize emptiness? It's so that we overcome suffering, you know, so that we overcome our anger and our greed and our resentment and our jealousy, you know, so that we can actually do something beneficial for others instead of harm them out of our confusion. Yeah? So we don't realize emptiness because emptiness is some other planet that's a good escape. We realize emptiness to use it to purify our mind so we can contribute to the well-being of others. Okay? So I think our spiritual practice has to be something that's very practical. I mean, yes, there can be extraordinary experiences and so on. But I think we somehow have to relate these to, you know, what life is, and not just use them as another high. Yeah? We had one young man come here, and he had a real substance abuse problem, you know, drinking, but mostly dope and psychedelics and all sorts of stuff. Actually, we've had more than one young person come here with this problem. We had a series of them now. You know? But some of them may be here now. you know, and he was in some way also using his meditation practice as, you know, to get some kind of high. And it became very hard for him, you know, because you can only have highs in your meditation practice for so often, you know, for so long before, you know, we have to face what is really going on in our mind. Yeah? So don't see meditation as, you know, an alternative universe that you're going to use to escape from things. Okay? Meditation is a way to see what's going on in our mind and to learn some self-acceptance, some tolerance and patience for ourselves, to learn kindness and compassion for ourselves, and to learn methods on how to transform these disturbing emotions and wrong views and so on, you know, so that we can be free from them. So it's really about learning and putting into practice and self-transformation. It's not about going to La La Land with Peter Pan. So sorry to disillusion you, but but I think that way our spiritual practice is really useful, you know, because if you go to La La Land with, you know, with a Buddha in your meditation, and then after your meditation you're getting angry at all these people, especially because they don't realize how spiritually superior you are because you just came back from La La Land, you know? And you get mad at them because they don't see your great spiritual qualities. Then, you know, kind of, what are we doing in La La Land anyway? You know, it's not terribly useful. So, you know, when we have those kind of, you know, kind of very strong spiritual experiences, we should come back and relate to people in a more humble way. You know, our spiritual practice should make us more humble. It should make us kinder. It should make us less egotistical. You know, not more, not, oh, I just had a vision of Buddha and Tara and everything. Have you had a vision of Buddha and Tara? Oh, too bad, you know. I'm this great spiritual seeker now, realized teacher, and follow me and I'll teach you to go to La La Land with me. You know, if you come out of your meditations and are thinking like that, have you subdued your ego? Have you diminished your arrogance and conceit? Have you become kinder and more humble? You know? So this is where it's very good to look at the living example of realized practitioners such as His Holiness the Dalai Lama. I mean, he's quite incredible. The Tibetans all think he's Chenrezig of Lokiteshvara, the Buddha of compassion. And, you know, Westerners, we like to come up, you know, the Tibetans are a little bit more discreet about this, but we run up, Your Holiness, are you really Chenrezig? You know? And His Holiness says, no, I'm a simple Buddhist monk. That's all. Simple Buddhist monk, just like everybody else. He doesn't say, oh, I'm glad you realized I'm the Buddha of compassion. Put your offerings here. He says, I'm a simple Buddhist monk. And when you relate to him, he's, you know, completely just, you know, a regular person. Except you see how incredibly, amazingly tolerant and patient he is and kind. I was there once when during some of these science conferences he's had, and there's one scientist who, in my quite unenlightened mind, is very arrogant. And at the beginning of the meeting, he came up to us all, "Oh, Your Holiness, I'm so glad to see you," and gave him a hug. And His Holiness is going, "Oh, I'm so glad to see you, so and so." And I'm going, "You know, that's not the way you greet the Dalai Lama." You know, like, he's your best friend. And His Holiness is just like so kind to this guy. And so, you know, just welcoming, "Oh, I'm so glad to see you." And I'm going, "This guy is so arrogant. How are you glad to see him? I'm not." You know? And there is where you see the real result of somebody who has spiritual realizations. You know? And because he's just completely, you know, open and friendly and relaxed and not offended by any of that. Okay? So, you know, just kind of keep this in mind. It's one thing to keep in mind. And so, you know, that kindness to ourselves and others, that compassionate mind that we're trying to cultivate and extend towards ourselves and towards others, is what we practice, you know, as we live together as a community. And so, in community life, you have the real delight of working together with people who have the same values and the same aspirations as you do and the same interests as you do. And you, you know, because everybody shares the same practice to some, you know. But you also have the joy of when they disagree with how to wash the dishes or how to vacuum the floor or how to plant the trees or how to stack the wood or, you know, where to shovel the dirt or any of these things, you know. Or how to print a book or how to design a building or, you know, all these kinds of things. And everybody has different ideas and everybody has different ways of doing things. And you count on other people to do things and sometimes they just haven't gotten around to doing it by the time you need it to be done. Yeah. And so, you know, working with all of this and cultivating compassion in the midst of all of this is how we really learn and grow and how we apply our spiritual practice to our life. Okay, so that all is really quite important. And so, you know, really watch the kinds of thoughts you have, watch the kinds of feelings you have. Write some of them down if you want to. Some of them might be really wonderful. Some of them might be the ones that you hope nobody will know about you. But forget about it, because we'll all know it about you. You know, because when we live together in community, I mean, we're with each other 24/7. Yeah. Sometimes people say, "Oh, you go and ordain and you live in a monastery and you're escaping reality." And I say, "Oh, if it were that easy to escape reality, I think everybody would shave their head and move to a monastery." You know? If all you had to do was that in order to get rid of, you know, all your upset and hurt and tragedy and grief, boy, you know, everybody would do it. But, you know, all of our internal mental conflicts, you know, come right with us into the monastery, and so we have to learn to become our own friend, you know, and not to criticize ourselves. Sometimes we will see our garbage, and sometimes we will see our beautiful, wonderful internal goodness, you know, and to be able to look at it all and say, "That's nice." Not like you're saying my anger is nice, but it's just, you know, I accept that right now I have anger. That doesn't mean in the future I want to cultivate my anger and continue, you know, acting out of my anger. But I accept the fact that it's here now, and I'm not going to criticize myself and tell myself I'm a lousy, unworthy, horrible person because I'm angry, you know. I just realize it's there, but I also know that there's a way to practice to be able to subdue it and transform it. Okay, so we learn a lot of that kind of self-acceptance, and it's really important, you know. And we learn to have more of a balanced mind, you know. So good things happen, we don't get too excited. Bad things happen, we don't get too upset, you know. We try and make our life smoother. This new table is rather smooth. Yes, it's like that, you know, this kind of smoothness. Yeah, but, you know, and then some people say, but don't you need suffering to know happiness? Yeah, and if you need to constantly suffer in order to know happiness, that's kind of... That doesn't sound too uplifting to me, to tell you the truth. Okay? I think we've already had enough suffering. I don't think we need to continue to suffer in order to know happiness and joy, you know. But we accept the suffering when it comes. We don't go looking for it. It comes uninvited by itself. But we accept it and learn to transform it into our spiritual practice. Okay? So that then everything we engage in becomes part of our practice, and we're trying to train our mind not to get too excited when one thing happens and too down when another thing happens. Okay? But instead to try and approach everything with some kind of kind feeling. Are you now kind of smooth emotionally? one of my teachers, Lama Yeshe, he said our minds are like yo-yos. Yeah. And it's really true. Yo-yos were quite the thing when I first met the Dharma. And, you know, back with the dinosaurs. and yo-yos, you know, they go up and they go down, and they go up and they go down. And we watch our mind all day long. Mm-hmm. We go up and we go down, and we go up and we go down. You know? Oh, I'm going to meet somebody nice. I go up. Oh, there's something I don't like for lunch. We go down. Oh, but there's chocolate on the snack table. We go down. Oh, I have to work in the compost bin. We go down. You know? So, you know, we watch our mind just like a yo-yo with all of its likes and dislikes and opinions and rules of the universe, the way we want things to be and the way things aren't. And we get exasperated and fed up and depressed. And you know, and then other times we're just ecstatic and we're on top of the world and we think nobody else has ever been this happy. You know? And so we watch this whole roller coaster, you know, this whole yo-yo show of our mind. And in the course of practice, learn to, you know, smooth the mind out. And having a smooth, balanced mind really has many advantages. We're not suppressing anything, okay? Don't get me wrong. Buddhism is not about suppressing emotions. Yeah, if you're suppressing your emotions, that's not practice, okay? But as you learn to have a smoother mind, then it means wherever you go, whoever you're with, there's the opportunity to be peaceful and content and happy. Yeah? Which I think is fantastic. It's better than all the ups and downs. Yeah? Because you take drugs and you go up, and then what happens? How long do you stay up? You come down. You know, one of my teachers went to the top of the Eiffel Tower and he said, that's nice, but the only place to go is down. Yeah? So it's the same way, you know, you get high and then you have to come down. What about, you know, learning to have a balanced mind that is content and fulfilled and, you know, not so, like, so much like a yo-yo. So this is kind of what we're aiming at, and it takes time, it takes practice, but what's really wonderful is just to know that we're going in the right direction. Okay, don't get real stuck on the result. And I know it's hard because especially, you know, in your early 20s, you always feel, okay, I got to get the result. You know, I got my high school diploma, now I got to get my college diploma, or I've got to get a job, or I've got to get this, or I've got to get that, or got to find the perfect relationship that's going to last for the next 75 years. How long did your parents' relationship last? So the mind wanting to get things and get a goal and accomplish something and say, okay, now here I am and I know this. But actually, you know, life is much more of a process. And so rather than focusing on the goal, you know, enjoy the process. So when you're meditating, don't judge whether you've had a good or a bad meditation. Good meditation meaning you feel good, bad meditation meaning you feel bad. Okay? Don't judge your meditation. Just do it. Be satisfied with it. Okay? And so, you know, don't worry about, am I going to be Buddha by next Tuesday? Sometimes we come and it's like, okay, I want to get this enlightenment business down and get enlightened already so I can get on with my life. You know? And it's not like that. It's not like that. The whole path is our life. You know? So focus on the process and really take joy in the process. And someday we'll get enlightened, you know. When all the causes and conditions are there, awakening will come, you know. So let's just create the causes and conditions and be content to do that and take joy in doing that and rejoice that everybody else is doing it too. Because it's really wonderful that all these other people are creating merit and you know, going along the path. Okay. Any questions so far?
The question is thinking about like patience and example you gave of like Swami's the Dalai Lama. And the example you gave of this one is the Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
And just thinking about the things that he's had to deal with you know, Chinese and the people that he had to love, having to love Mao, that's a pretty difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm just wondering, like, what are the kinds of conditions that are really helpful for developing patience? Do you have to be, like, do you have to put yourself in really hard circumstances with really hard people? Mm-hmm. Or is it just his day-to-day life? Or just mind training itself enough to have patience?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you're talking about His Holiness Dalai Lama and all the incredibly difficult situations he's had to face in his life. And so you're wondering whether we need to face those real difficult situations or if we can practice in our daily life with less difficult situations. And, you know, to develop that kind of patience and fortitude, actually. We practice with whatever comes to us. Yeah? We don't need to go looking for difficult situations. And, you know, sometimes difficult situations are our daily life. And you know what's really interesting as you practice is you begin to realize that it's our mind that makes the situation difficult. It's not the situation itself. It's our mind that makes it difficult. Yeah? And I think one of the reasons that His Holiness Dalai Lama was, you know, has these exemplary qualities that you were speaking of is because his mind doesn't make the situation difficult. Like with Mao, meeting Mao, and Mao telling His Holiness directly, religion is the opiate of the people, and, you know, religion needs to be dismantled. You know, if His Holiness looks at Mao in one way, it's like this guy is the, you know, biggest idiot in town, and, you know, with all sorts of horrible wrong views, and, you know, he should be killed. You know, you could look at Mao that way. I'm sure many people did. His Holiness looked at Mao and said, here's a sentient being who's suffering. Here's somebody who wants to be happy, who doesn't know how to create the causes of happiness. And he thinks that obliterating religion and increasing his own power is going to bring him happiness. And that's sad. So His Holiness, his mind, by the way he interpreted the situation, didn't make it into a problem. So we begin to see, as we practice more and more, how it's really our mind that makes the situation difficult. Because you can find two people in the same situation. One person is wailing and so unhappy, and the other person is perfectly okay. And it's not because the situation is different. It's because the minds of the people are different. And so even, I mean, one of the things in Buddhism is this kind of teachings called mind training or thought transformation, where one of the chief things in that is transforming adversity into the path, which is really extraordinary teaching. And so Lama Yeshe, he was, let's see, he was 24 in 1959. He was at Sera Monastery. And so when there was the abortive uprising in Lhasa, and when His Holiness fled and went into exile, the monks in Sera Monastery just took their teacups and went into the mountains. Tibetans always carry their teacups. And they thought, you know, we'll be in the mountains for a few days, everything will calm down, we'll go back to Sera, continue our education. You know, Lama was studying for his Geshe degree and doing all the courses, and, you know, thought, okay, we'll be in the mountains, you know, a few days, go back to Lhasa, everything will be back to normal. Everything didn't get back to normal. When they realized that, you know, when people realized the danger to His Holiness, that the communists could very well kill him and may have wanted to, then he went over the Himalayas in March when it's freezing, into exile. And when the monks heard about this, tens of thousands of monks also went over the Himalayas into India, into exile. And so Lama was one of them, you know, never went back to Sera, had his teacup and wound up continuing on to India. In Tibet, you're at the highest place in the world, you know, there's very little bacteria and virus. India, you're lower down, filled with bacteria and virus, especially arriving in March, coming into the pre-monsoon time when it's very humid. And, you know, thousands of Tibetans died there. The monks were put into an old British POW camp. Did you watch 7 Years in Tibet? Mm-hmm. Yeah? So, the Heinrich Herr, and, you know, he was in that POW camp. And that was the same one that later they put the monks in. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Lama was there for a number of years, and, you know, extremely poor, people getting sick, many dying all the time. And Lama, one time, I remember very clearly, he was telling us the story of how he went into exile. And he said, you know, going into exile was something that was in one way hard, but he said it was actually very, very good. Because he said, otherwise I would have gone ahead, gotten my Geshe degree, gone back to my hometown, been the big Geshe in the monastery. I wouldn't have ever really known how to practice Dharma because people would be bringing me all these offerings and bowing to me, and I would have just become very complacent and fat and happy. And he said, it's Mao Zedong that taught me the real meaning of Dharma. You know, it's Mao Zedong and going into exile that taught me what practicing the Buddhist teachings actually meant. And then Lama put his hands together and he said, I really have to thank Mao. Isn't that amazing? You know, would you find it easy to thank the person that messed up your life completely and made you become a refugee? So, you know, this kind of thing is what I mean by the mind makes the situation difficult or the mind makes the situation easy, you know, and the mind gets depressed and totally lost, or the mind, you know, transforms and sees the good qualities in the experience. Yeah. So this is exactly what Dharma practice is about. So that's why I say don't go looking for difficult experiences, because our mind will make anything difficult. Yeah. And you can see that living in community. And you can see that. I mean, it's fascinating. We just how the mind works, because our mind, our confused mind, our deluded mind, you know, it always makes some scene. It always makes a scene about something, okay? Because when we make a scene, then we feel like we exist. So here we are, the richest country on the planet, you know, and we're not really wanting for anything. In fact, you know, having a TV is, how do I say this right? That if you don't have a TV, then you're considered impoverished in this country? You know, if you don't have a TV. Yeah. And yet, I mean, I've lived internationally quite a bit in my life. Many people don't have TVs. And yet, for us, oh, I don't have a TV, I'm suffering. Or I don't have an iPad or an iPod or a cell phone, I'm suffering. Yeah. Or I only have one computer, you know, not the kind I want, and I can't get the program I want, I'm suffering. Yeah. And so our mind becomes dissatisfied and makes problems at anything. Yeah? And you know, when you live in an impoverished country and are impoverished, our problems seem like luxuries. And the people are saying, oh, if I only had the luxury of, you know, being, my biggest problem were that I don't have a cell phone, or that the camera on my cell phone broke. Wow, may that be the biggest problem I ever have. And yet, it's so amazing how sometimes the level of upset in these two different situations, somebody who's really having a hard time making ends meet and somebody whose cell phone broke, you know, the level of suffering in the mind is about the same. And that's because the mind creates the suffering. Yeah? Are you getting what I'm saying? And so, and this is our afflictive mind, our deluded mind, and this is precisely the mind that we're trying to transform and subdue, because who wants more suffering? We've already had enough. Okay? So we're not blaming ourselves when our mind creates suffering. Don't get into that trip of I'm such a lousy person because my mind's so uncontrolled that I make a mountain out of a molehill. You know, don't get into all that self-criticism. That's just more unnecessary suffering. You know? But, you know, we just notice it and then think, well, how can I change my perspective? Yeah. One of our cats, Manjushri, he died a few months ago, but he had three legs. And he didn't always have three legs. He had four legs at one point. And then he got a tumor on one leg and it had to be amputated. And so for the rest of his life, he hopped around on three legs. And right after the leg was amputated, I mean, think about how you would feel if you, one of your legs were amputated. I mean, we would probably just go into panic and like, oh my God. And, how am I going to get around? What am I going to do? And what are people? What will people think of me? And I'm not going to be able to participate with everybody else and go dancing and go partying the way that everybody else does. And who's going to love me? Because they don't want somebody with love somebody with a wooden leg or a plastic leg or, you know, well, what am I going to do? And I can't go swimming and on and on and on. And, you know, we would just get completely crazy. And Manjushri kind of came out of the anesthetic, and it was like, well, that really didn't feel very good. But okay, three paws, not four. Let's get on with life. And he was hopping up and down the stairs in the house in no time. Yeah. And he was just such a good lesson to me, because I thought, you know, it just shows that our mind is what creates the difficulty. And, you know, and our, with a human mind, we have so much incredible potential and so much beauty and so many things we can do that are extraordinary that an animal can't do. But we also have, you know, that same mind can create so much more suffering than an animal's mind can create. Okay? So we want to really use our beautiful inner human beauty in a good way and train our mind so that we create joy for ourselves and others and not pain. Does that answer your question okay? Yeah. Anybody else have questions or comments? Okay, so that was the introduction. I usually like to meditate before I give the talk. So, why don't we do a few minutes of meditation and then I'll just have a few words at the conclusion of the session too. So there's many different kinds of meditation and many different ways of meditating. The Tibetan tradition especially is very replete with all different kinds of meditation. So we're going to do one here. I think you were doing it last night, this morning, on the breath. And we're going to do it to calm the mind and stabilize the mind. Okay, so just watching the breath as it goes in and out. You may have noticed that your mind wanders all over the place. When it does, just observe to what kind of object your mind wanders to and what kind of emotion it wanders to. Okay? So you don't get into a big conversation about all of this, you know, because your main object of meditation is your breath. But if all of a sudden I'm sitting there, you know, and I'm off the breath and I'm thinking about lunch and wondering what's going to be for lunch, then, okay, food is the object I'm wandering to, And attachment, desire, clinging, craving is the emotion that, you know, I'm wandering with. Or you might be breathing and then, you know, you remember one of your professors, or you remember your sibling or your parents or somebody who said something you didn't like to you, and, you know, you get upset. And, okay, the object is the words that person said, and the emotion is anger or upset. So you just notice that, but then come back to the breath. Don't stay with that object and continue your story about it. Just notice that you went there and then come back. Okay? And so as you do this, just, you know, notice the patterns of the objects your mind wanders to and the emotions it wanders with. Okay? Okay, so first, wiggle. Okay? Wiggle. Wiggle. Come on, move your arms. Wiggle your arms. Yeah? Okay, this is your wiggle time. Then you won't have to wiggle during your meditation. Okay? Okay, and then now you can come back, and your hands are right on your left. Your arms touching. Your arms should not be flat against your body. Yeah, they shouldn't be flat against your body. They should be out a little bit. Not like chicken wings, but there should be some space between your arms and your torso. Okay? So take a minute to just feel yourself sitting here on the cushion. And then bring your attention to the breath, focusing either on the rising and falling of your belly. Your belly should extend as you inhale and fall as you, or go in when you exhale. Or you can also focus at your nostrils and upper lip and feel the sensation of the air as it passes there. So choose one of those two places, but keep it there for the entire session. And let your breathing pattern be quite normal, natural. Don't push it. But really be aware of everything that's happening as you're inhaling and exhaling. And if there's a pause at any point in the process, be aware of what happens then. And if you get distracted, notice that you got distracted, but bring your attention back home to the breath. So let's dedicate the merit. You have the blue sheet. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born,